Today's last word in business is mbop. That 1997 song made three young brothers known as Hanson famous. The pop group has faded in popularity, though the Hansons are still making music, and they're older, old enough to drink now. So next year, instead of releasing a new album, Zach Taylor and Isaac Hanson are bringing out beer. It'll be an India Pale Ale, and they're naming it Mhop. The group is choosy about their merchandise. They have a board game bearing their name, but Zach, who's now 26, says, "We will never make dolls." And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
Stop. That song's going to be in my head forever. I'm Steve Inskeep. Some years ago, Eric Weiner suffered abdominal pain. The writer and former NPR correspondent ended up in the emergency room.
And this nurse walks in, and she sees I'm scared. I mean, I was just reeking of fear. And she bends over to draw blood or something like that, and she whispers in my ear these words I will never forget. She said, "Have you found your God yet?"
Doctors eventually found nothing wrong with Eric Weiner, but the nurse's question about finding God made him wonder if something really was wrong. He'd previously written a book called Geography of Bliss about a hunt for happiness, and now Weiner began another quest to find religion. He wrote a book on his experience called Man Seeks God, and he came by our studios to talk about it. You had this prompt to explore your own faith and try to find out what it was, but you grew up Jewish. Why not just go in that direction, go a little more deeply in that direction?
Well, I grew up as a very specific kind of Jew, Steve. I grew up as a gastronomical Jew, which is basically bagels, lox, gefilte fish. You know, if it were edible, then it was Jewish and supposedly had something to do with God. I'm really not kidding. And you're right, I could stick with my heritage, but it just struck me as that was a bit of a cop-out. If I was going to answer this nurse's question, then I needed to look as broadly as possible.
Now, as a Jew, you went first naturally to Islam.
I dove headfirst into Islam for a couple of reasons. One is that this is the 800-pound God in the room, right? I mean, everyone has an opinion about Islam, even if they don't express it. But I couldn't look at all of Islam. As you know, it's this huge religion that spans many sects and many regions. So I chose the one that appealed to me the most, and that's the Sufis, the mystical sect of Islam.
In the end, Sufism didn't seem to sway you. It wasn't the end of your quest in any case.
It was not the end, but I have to say I loved whirling like a dervish. I took lessons in whirling.
How does one whirl like a dervish, if you can describe that on the radio?
Well, very carefully, it turns out. It's not really a dance. It's a spiritual activity.
Are you actually whirling? You're spinning like a figure skater on one toe?
Yes, you are in one place, and the really serious dervishes will practice on a nail so that their foot stays put on that nail as they whirl. I didn't do that. But the idea is that it's prayer in motion as you're turning. You're sort of praying. You're in what they call zikr, or remembrance of God. They say if you're close to God, you don't get dizzy. I nearly lost it. I was so not dizzy. So I guess I have work to do. But I did, for that briefest of moments, experience what it felt like to turn effortlessly. And then, of course, I announced to everyone who was watching me, "Look, I'm turning. It's amazing." And then promptly nearly fell over.
Oh, it's the being conscious of yourself that caused you to do that.
Well, Rumi, the great Sufi poet, said, "Never analyze enthusiasm." And I made that mistake.
So you continue further east, get into other religions. You end up in Kathmandu, the capital of Nepal.
I do. I was diving into Tibetan Buddhism. There are several hundred thousand Tibetan Buddhists in Kathmandu. And I was seriously in search of a lama to teach me Buddhist meditation. And I was looking, and I couldn't find one. And finally, someone suggested to me, "Have you considered Wayne?" And I'm thinking, well, which part of Tibet is Wayne from? And they said, "Oh, the Staten Island part." So I'm thinking, well, this isn't really why I flew to Kathmandu. But it turns out that Wayne of Staten Island had been living in Kathmandu for 30 years. He was an accomplished Buddhist and meditator, and I agreed to work with Wayne. So every morning we would climb up onto his roof in Kathmandu with the Himalayas in the background, and I would attempt to still my monkey mind, as the Buddhists call it, this tendency for our minds to dart around and to never stay in one place.
So you're not whirling this time. You're trying to be still.
Well, my mind is whirling, but I'm still.
Okay.
And we worked at it and worked at it, and I'm sitting there, and I'm trying to just watch my breath. And this worked for about 3 seconds. And then my mind starts to obsess about, for some reason, nail clippers. I didn't bring any with me. And I become concerned, I mean, seriously concerned, that my nails will grow to these sort of Howard Hughes-esque proportions, that there are no nail clippers in all of Kathmandu.
So as soon as you try to empty your mind, random anxieties fill up that space right away. That's
right.
What happened to you.
Things, and this is what I discovered on the spiritual journey, is that things often get worse before they get better.
Why do you write, Eric Weiner, that as you explored more and more religions, you actually became more depressed?
I think it's what's known as a karmic reckoning. This idea, you know, that as you dive into this stuff, you're really familiarizing yourself with your mind, the Buddhists would say, with your heart, the Sufis would say, with God, the Christians would say. You know, it's like ripping off the bandage and you realize there's this gaping wound on your arm or in your chest, and you're like, oh my God, I've got a terrible wound there. And then ideally, as you go about a spiritual practice, you start to do something about it.
Did things get any easier when you went to New York City to spend time with Franciscan friars?
Yes and no. Easier in that I was on my home turf now, on more familiar terrain in the sense that it's Christianity. And that comes fully loaded in its own way. Sitting in Catholic Mass as a Jew, a gastronomical Jew, but still a Jew, attempting to cross myself and just doing it all wrong, and my arms are flailing every which way. But, you know, living cheek by jowl with them, as I did for a while, I saw what good work they did running a homeless shelter in the South Bronx. And they've taken these vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. Now, I've experienced two of those, chastity and poverty, in my life, but never voluntarily. And here they've taken the vow for all three, but they never felt in denial. You know, I would ask them, you know, wouldn't you rather have the latest iPhone? Or, you know, I just had this impression that they woke up every day really having to suppress these basic human needs for things like sex and stuff. And they were not like that at all. They had made a choice. And they felt basically that by having, say, no stuff, they didn't have stuff to worry about. They didn't have to worry about upgrading to stuff 2.0 or people stealing their stuff. In a way, it's very liberating.
Let me ask about your own journey then, Eric Weiner. As you go along through these various religious practices, you say at one point when you're being asked to believe something, my disbelief refused to suspend itself.
Right.
Did you end up, in the end, with something to hold on to?
No. I didn't. I'm sort of holding on to a lot of things at once. I think it is possible to create a sort of IKEA God, some assembly required. You know, this idea that you can cobble together your sort of own personal religion, a sort of mixtape of God. What I conclude is you need a foundation. And in my case, that is Judaism. I did come back to the spiritual aspect of Judaism, Kabbalah, and find that I need that foundation. But on top of that foundation, you can add all kinds of things. So I'm sort of in perpetual seeker mode, but I think that's okay.
Eric Weiner is the author of Man Seeks God. Thanks very much for coming by, Eric.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Let's turn to a much smaller economic story, one that could mean a lot to certain people. It has to do with the design of a cup of instant soup. The shape of this product might increase injuries, and a simple change can make a big difference. How that design came about and the effort to change it is a story for Mana Zapata of NPR's Planet Money team.
You know these soups. Some come in a styrofoam cup. You stick them in a microwave or add boiling water, and a few minutes later, they're ready to eat. Here's Dr. Warren Garner, director of the burn unit at USC's hospital in Los Angeles.
I don't have them in my house. I encourage everyone I know to not have them. I would say that we see at least two or three patients a week who've been injured by these products.
Just about everyone who works at Dr. Garner's unit is terrified of these products. Like Anna Beltran. She used to enjoy the occasional cup of soup herself before she started working here as a nurse.
But now I just absolutely cringe. I can be at a supermarket paying for my groceries, look behind me, and there's a mom with two young children buying a big pack of cup of noodles, and I just can't help but ask her to please be careful.
I should mention here, there's a specific brand called Cup Noodles, but Beltran and others use Cup of Noodles as shorthand for all of the different brands of instant soups and cups. What makes these soups so dangerous has to do with the way the product is designed. The cups are tall, lightweight, and have an unstable base. They tip over easily. Dr. Garner at the burn unit at USC says the most common cases are small children, often toddlers, accidentally tipping the cup over onto themselves.
It pulls down on top of them. The hot liquid then burns their chest, arms, torso, sometimes their privates, occasionally their legs.
Are there other injuries that you see as regularly that can be so directly attributed to the product design?
No. This is a uniquely troublesome product.
I called a dozen burn units at hospitals across the country, and the story is pretty much the same. Injured patients, mostly children. A few hospitals see a patient every once in a while, but 8 of the 12 hospitals I called said they see the injury about 1 to 3, and sometimes as many as 6 times a week. It turns out noodle soup is strangely perfect for delivering a serious burn. Unlike coffee or tea, noodles conduct heat and stay hotter longer. The sticky noodles cling to the skin, which leads to deeper, more severe burns. Dr. Garner says that about 1 in 5 children he sees end up needing surgery. His patients can face permanent scarring and limited mobility in their joints. Studies show that hospital stays for upper body noodle soup burns are more than twice as long as scalds from hot liquids alone. But not all noodle soup cups are equally dangerous.
These are the different designs of soup in a Vietnamese grocery store. That doesn't take much to knock them over, as opposed to knocking.
I'm swatting at different cups of soup with Dr. David Greenhall, chief of burns at Shriners Hospital for Children in Northern California, and the author of a study entitled Instant Cup of Soup, Design Flaws Increase Risk of Burns.
Seems like we get a scald burn and it says, well, what's this from? Oh, another cup of noodle soup just came to me. It's like, well, you know, it's a very simple test. Can you knock over one kind of cup more than another?
That was the study's question. So they went to the grocery store and bought 11 brands of soup manufactured all over the world, and then calculated the angle at which the soup tipped over and spilled. Not surprisingly, tall cups with a narrow bottom tip over about 3 times more easily than short, squat containers with a wide, stable base.
This is Cup Noodles by Nissin. Pull back lid to dotted line, fill cup with boiling water. Close the lid.
One of the worst, most prone to tip brands in Dr. Greenhall's study is also one of the cheapest and most popular. The company invented the product 40 years ago and has sold more than 25 billion worldwide. Cup Noodles by Nissin. Their cup spills at 22 degrees. Compare that to the best performer, a brand called Nice Cook, with a shallow, squat container. You need to turn Nice Cook almost vertical, 64 degrees, before it tips over. Dr. Greenhall says this problem might have an elegant and potentially low-cost solution. Imagine a Yoplait yogurt container, skinny on top, wide on bottom. In other words, says Dr. Greenhall, just invert the design of the cup.
All I have to do is flip it over. It would seem to be a very easy thing to do, and I think I could get some of my team members to go to one of the companies and say, here, why don't you try this?
I reached out to Nissin and manufacturers of some of the other tippiest cups in Dr. Greenhall's study. I wanted to know if they'd been sued, how much they'd settled for, and how much it would cost to redesign the cups. Every company declined to comment or failed to get back to me. Dr. Greenhall calculates that his simple change, inverting the cup, would make cup noodles almost 3 times less likely to tip, comparable to the safest brand in his study. For NPR News, I'm Mata Zepeda in Los Angeles.
And you can find Dr. Greenhall's study and see illustrations of the reimagined inverted cup at npr.org. Planet Money.
Martha Stewart is, could we call her America's tastemaker? Her fans think she can do anything beautifully. Even people who profess not to like her own her books and cook her recipes. She has a new book called Martha's Entertaining, A Year of Celebration, sort of like her first book almost 30 years ago, which was called Entertaining.
The first book really was kind of an entertaining textbook for the homemaker. I couldn't find a good book about entertaining in 1982, and neither could my friends, so I decided to write it. At the time, I was a caterer. And
one of the reviews says, caterer Martha Stewart, and then goes on to describe
right, and I was catering lots and lots of parties, so we photographed the most interesting of the parties. This book is very different because these were all my own personal parties and events that I had at my own home or my weekend home out in East Hampton or up in Maine at my summer house.
Now, the pictures, are, as you say, are taken in your very extraordinary homes, and you serve beautiful food on amazing china, beautiful flatware, and all the wonderful glass. How are we meant to think about this book? I mean, this is obviously not the homemaker kind of book.
Well, in a way it is, because what I did in this book was try to capture sort of the essence of what we would all like to do when we entertain, which was make wonderful food from really good recipes, set a pretty table or a beautiful buffet, make flower arrangements, cut from our own gardens. It's kind of a dreamscape in a way, but there are many, many practical and interesting and inspiring kinds of moments throughout the book that I think will enable people to have a pretty Easter, have a wonderful 4th of July, have a inspiring Christmas.
I must say that my first run through the book, I was thinking some people would look at this book and decide that if this is what a Christmas party should look like, it would spend the holiday under the bed.
Oh, no. That's not what it's meant to do at all. It's just I'd make the Christmas cookies that are in the book because they're really cute. And I certainly would make a croquembouche.
The Noah's Ark cookies.
Yes,
those
aren't they great? Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're really great.
Now, when you decorate for Christmas, you can see in the background of all the pictures that there are Christmas trees everywhere and wreaths in every window, and it's incredibly beautiful. I understand you keep all your Christmas decorations in the basement of the farm at Bedford?
Yeah. We have a very organized basement. You would love it down there. I don't know if you're an archivist at all, but it's all organized in those plastic tubs on a big floor-to-ceiling shelves. So we know where everything is. We create Christmas. That's one of our big things every year for television, for the magazine. And so I'm always adding to my collections of stuff. and it's a lot of fun to this year. Oh, I'm doing a whole new thing for the new grandchild. Baby Jude is having a brown bear Christmas.
Oh, my goodness.
Because we made a whole lot of ornaments in the shape of bears this year. So I think that would be sort of cute for a baby who's about 10 months old, don't you?
I think it would be. Of course it would be. Now, I have to say, though, there's a picture of opening the chapter of a ceramic nativity scene that you have on display. It looks like drabware.
Yes, Wedgwood drabware.
That with a sort of light brown coffee cream color.
You caught that, did you?
I just could not quite believe it when I read the caption.
All right. Should I tell you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's kind of a funny story. When I was incarcerated at Alderson in West Virginia for a 5-month term, they had a ceramics class. And in the ceramics class was a storage warehouse room where I found all the molds for an entire large nativity scene. It took me a long time to find each mold, and because I was raised a Catholic, I know the story.
I know the characters,
right? I know the wise men and the camels and all of that stuff. But it's a big thing. I think there's about 15 pieces, and I was able to purchase enough clay with my monthly stipend, and I forwent. Is that a word? Forwent. I didn't get a lot of other things that I would have liked in that 5-month period because I bought clay instead, and I molded the entire nativity scene. And then I had to figure out how to paint it drab color because there's 6 different colors of paint that you could get. But I managed to fashion a drab color, and it looks just like Wedgwood.
One of the things that I was fascinated about this book was that each chapter begins with an explanation of what the entertainment is, you know, an Easter egg party, a Christmas party, a boat party. And then there is a printed menu, and there are lots of pictures of beautiful table settings and flowers and whatnot. And then in some cases, you include a picture where the table is not been cleared, but all the people have left. So the chairs are like pushed back every sort of way, and the napkins are just crumpled up on the table.
That was the morning after a Burgundy dinner. When I bought that beautiful house in Maine, which had been built by Edsel Ford, by the way, they built a wine cellar right in the stone foundation of the house. It's built right into the granite mountain. And when I bought the house from the second family that owned it, they left their wine cellar for me, which was filled with aging Burgundy. So I was told by an expert, a wine expert friend, he said, boy, you better drink this Burgundy. It's going to go over the hill soon. So we designed a Burgundy dinner, and we drank and drank and drank bottles of delicious 85s and 82s, and it was time, and they were good. And we served them with short ribs and beautiful fig and apple tarts, and none of us felt like cleaning up after this elaborate dinner. So, and the table actually, I thought, looked kind of interesting. So we left it, and next morning we photographed it. If you are a careful hostess, though, you would pour a little bit of water into each of the glasses so that the wine doesn't etch the beautiful crystal. Do you know that?
And did you remember to do it?
I did.
Of course you did. Well, thank you very much for this.
Okay.
Martha Stewart's newest book, which I believe is book number 75. Could that possibly be right?
Yes, it is.
It's called Martha's Entertaining, A Year of Celebrations. Martha Stewart, thank you very much. There's a recipe for Noah's Ark cookies at NPR.org, also a picture of that nativity scene. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Speaking of traditions, it's that time of year again, and if you've been out shopping for gifts at a toy store lately, you know that you can easily spend hundreds of dollars on just a few items. And kids are notorious beggars for that must-have toy, a toy they seem to forget about a few weeks later. So why not just rent the toys? Just like a DVD rental plan with monthly fees, there are a few websites out there that let you select toys online that are then mailed to your house. Shipping charges are free, by the way. And when your kid gets tired of them, you just send them back and the company sends you the next toys in your queue. The concept has gotten some big name support. One site, it's called Toy Guru, got a boost earlier this year when business mogul Mark Cuban signed on as an investor. So for the low, low price of, say, $24.99, you can get yourself a bucket of toys that you can keep for a couple of months, which is just about when your kids will be completely over them. Just like all of your toys. Military chaplains fulfill a lot of roles. Yes, they conduct religious services for members of the military, working at home or in war zones, but they also serve as counselors, helping troops deal with the complicated questions surrounding war. The large majority of military chaplains are Protestant Christians, and they're supposed to support all troops, no matter their religious affiliation. But our next guest says military chaplains aren't addressing the introspective needs of military atheists. Jason Torpy is the president of the Military Association of Atheist and Free Thinkers. He's been working on getting the military to bring in some atheist chaplains. Jason Torpy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'm glad to be here.
So you have since left the military. You were deployed to Iraq in 2003. Did you ever have any personal interactions with a military chaplain? Did you seek guidance or advice?
Oh, of course. All the time. You know, my organization really supports what the chaplains do, why they're there. And especially in the last 10 to 20 years, they've acquired a lot of secular responsibilities, essentially counseling, retreats, family counseling, marriage counseling, deployment counseling, suicide counseling. And a lot of those responsibilities, you know, right or wrong, has been put on the chaplains. And to the extent those chaplains can attend to a faith-based solution to that for those who share that chaplain's faith, that's fine. But for any given chaplain, that's likely to be a small portion of the population. even for Christian chaplains. So I point the finger at them not because they're always the problem, but because they are the solution.
Can you give some examples of circumstances where, as an atheist, as a humanist, you felt left out?
Going on a military mission, for example. You know, we were getting ready to roll out, and everybody come in. So as the commander of this convoy, everybody come in. We're going to do a prayer first together. We're not going to talk about communications. We're not going to talk about route planning. We're not going to talk about first aid. We're not going to talk about maintenance. So I had to opt myself out of that situation, to out myself, because this commander took it upon himself to have a personal religious activity in the midst of a military mission.
You didn't participate?
No.
How did you walk away from that?
Well, as a captain, there's a lot fewer people that can tell me what to do. Now, the person that was in command was a major, so I was still, you know, stepping outside. He was extremely unhappy about it. He said, oh, you know, why are you creating trouble? I said, you know, why are you creating trouble? Why are you excluding me from this activity? This is a military mission, and I support your right to pray, but right this second we have a military mission, and for you to use your power to pull everyone in to do a Christian prayer is wrong.
So why atheist chaplains? This may be the obvious question, but why not just push for more secular counselors? Why is it important to have an atheist in the chaplaincy, which you think of as a religious group?
There are individuals that they don't have those traditional religious perspectives. And some of those individuals want to serve as officers in the military. That's how they want to serve the nation, to do chaplain work. And they can do that in a way that Christians can't do it. So if you replace humanist chaplains for Jewish or Muslim or Hindu chaplains, the objection is just as invalid. You say, these people believe differently than I do. How could they help everyone, service members?
But that's how it is now. There are chaplains who are Christian or Buddhist or Jewish,
right,
and they're expected to minister to everyone.
Well, minister is not the right term. They're expected to support everyone. And that leap to ensure that they have the training to understand us, and to ensure that chaplains are required to stock our materials and provide facilities and support to provide for our community, just as they do everyone else, that is the leap that the chaplains have not been able to make yet.
What do they say? What's the pushback?
Well, essentially they say, well, we're not saying no because we want to support everybody, but we're also not saying yes either. One note also, it's important to understand this in historical context. Chaplains in 1775 were established by George Washington to give Protestant prayers to troops. Fast forward 200 years, essentially. And in 1992, the first non-Christian, non-Jewish chaplain was a Muslim chaplain. More recently, Buddhist chaplains and Hindu chaplains have been added. The chaplaincy is extending their diversity, but it's only in the last 20 years. And this last thing, again, once you had monotheists, polytheists, pantheists, and once they extend to non-theists, the chaplaincy will have embraced all of the service members and the breadth of life stances and deeply held personal philosophies. And I really hope they can do that.
That's Jason Torpy. He's president of the Military Association of Atheists and Freethinkers. He's been speaking with me from our studios in Washington. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.